I'm joined this morning by Professor Betsy McCoach from the University of Connecticut, a professor of measurement, evaluation, and assessment. And we'll find out what that means, but she's done a study to show that students in poverty are less likely to be identified as gifted. And we'll talk about that whole concept this morning with Betsy. Good morning, Betsy. Thanks for coming in today. And how was your drive in this morning?
Oh, it wasn't bad at all. Much better than I was expecting.
Well, you didn't see 6 to 12 inches of snow out there, huh?
No, okay. I didn't. And I didn't even have to plow my driveway, which is great.
Yes, that's the best news of all. No shoveling necessary. All right. Students in poverty less likely to be identified as gifted. What was the inspiration for your study that came up with that conclusion?
Well, so we have the National Research Center. I got to get the title right. The National Center for Research on Gifted Education is housed at the University of Connecticut. And so there was a competitive grant that's funded by the Department of Education, actually the Institute for Education Sciences, which is part of the department. And they were really interested in two issues when they funded this center. One was, are students who are sort of traditionally underserved in education, so our students who are Black, Latino, Native American, and also our students who live in poverty, are they less likely to be identified as gifted? There was sort of a sense out there that that was the case, but we were supposed to kind of do a deeper dive into that. And then the second thing was, do gifted programs work? So those were the two things, right? How can we do a better job identifying equitably, and do gifted programs actually serve the kids in them? So we spent the last 3 years actually looking at both of those questions. We're still working on the do gifted programs work question, so I'm not going to really talk much about that today. So I had a theory, which was we all kind of knew that Black, Latino students were less likely to be identified as gifted. You could see that in gifted programs as you walked around from program to program. You could see there weren't as many students of color in gifted programs. But I thought that that might have something to do with the fact that they weren't doing as well on achievement tests. And so they were being overlooked because their academic achievement was lower. And then if we controlled for academic achievement, so if we sort of equated kids, if we said, okay, how about, is a Black student who has similar achievement scores as likely to be identified as gifted as a white student with the same scores? I thought if we put them on the same footing in terms of their achievement tests, that gap is going to go away. And so the big news of this study is wrong. Actually, you can two kids, Black kid, white kid, same achievement test scores. The Black kid is still less likely to be identified. Free and reduced price lunch kid, non-free and reduced price lunch student with the same scores. The student who receives free and reduced price lunch is still less likely to be identified as gifted.
Yeah, take me a step further on that. What was the role of the school lunch program in this study?
Well, so we don't, of course, have access to people's personal financial income information. As researchers, we would love to have that kind of information, right? But as you can imagine, as people out there, you really would not like us to actually have your exact income information. So the only way that we can really look at poverty with pre-existing data is to look at whether or not a student receives free or reduced price lunch. So that's the best information that we have about who are low-income students. So so we knew that. And it turns out that free and reduced price lunch ends up, you know, being a pretty good proxy for low-income status, as you can imagine.
So how did you get your information, and what areas did you decide to study?
I should back up just a little bit and say that gifted education is kind of interesting because even though this center is funded by the federal government, there's no federal mandate to identify and serve gifted students. So we chose three states that do have a state mandate to identify and serve gifted students. So we couldn't actually work in the state of Connecticut because this is kind of interesting. In the state of Connecticut, and things are changing a little bit. There have been some laws passed recently that are making, you know, sort of making things a little better. But In the state of Connecticut, there's a mandate to identify students as gifted, but there's no mandate to have a gifted program and serve those students, which is kind of weird. So district has to identify students, but they don't have to do anything once they've identified them. So we chose three states that actually have a mandate to identify and a mandate to serve, because we thought, if you have to identify kids as gifted, but you don't have to do anything with them, how seriously are you really going to take that identification process, right? And in fact, you can imagine in states where you don't identify, they don't take it. I mean, some districts take it seriously, some don't. So we found three states that we thought were really stellar states in terms of gifted ed, states that had strong laws. Some of them actually have some budget, you know, attached to gifted education, that they actually give districts money for gifted ed, which you wouldn't see here in the state of Connecticut. That's not a thing. So we found three really good states, and we asked them for their state data for a cohort, an entire state's worth of students for, like, you know, one cohort. So it's not like we have every kid who's ever gone through, but it's kids who were third graders in, I think, 2011, 2012, fifth graders in 2013, 2014. And we have 3 years of their data. Third grade, fourth grade, and fifth grade. So it's like 100,000 kids about in each state.
Can you identify the states that you surveyed this morning?
No, I can't.
I noticed you keep it kind of vague.
State there. One, state two, and state three.
How do you define what a gifted student is?
That's a problem. Because every state has a different definition of gifted. Some states don't even have a definition, and so they leave it up to the school district to define what a gifted student is. But most states that have strong laws have some sort of very vague general definition, and then the districts have to decide how to identify. So what, I mean, that's kind of the biggest problem in the field of gifted education, is that people can't really answer the question, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to be gifted? Which, of course, you know, if you can't answer that, then you're kind of sunk as a field. But because it really varies from place to place. So there is a federal definition that has no teeth, but it says, you know, that you need to be gifted or talented in one of many areas. And so they talk about academics and leadership and, you know, lots of, it's a very, very broad definition. So in most places, though, I would say, well, I shouldn't say most places. In a lot of places, being gifted sort of revolves around having high academic skills or abilities, right? Somebody, a kid who is exceeding what you would expect in terms of math or reading or sort of general cognitive ability.
Betsy, can a student be classified as non-gifted and then be reclassified later on as gifted, maybe through a different study or through some kind of academic means? Or once you are not listed as gifted, are you not gifted throughout your academic career?
That's a great question. So absolutely, a student who's not identified as gifted can be identified as gifted. And all of the identification process happens within school districts. So it happens, you know, at the school, but it's the school district that makes the decision about how to identify students as gifted. So every school district has different criteria, different identification methods. So generally speaking, you know, students could be identified anywhere along, you know, K through 12. Here's the thing, though. Once you're identified, theoretically, you could be unidentified. But unlike other types of labels that get applied to kids in schools, gifted's kind of a nice one. And so people don't want their kids to lose the label once they've been identified. So you can be identified at any time, and theoretically you could, you know, there should be fluidity about identification. I mean, it should really be about, do you need a service? You get identified. If you no longer need the service, you don't, you know, you maybe lose the label. But people don't want to lose the label gifted. Once right, they so have that label, they want to keep it.
So you're in middle school, and you're labeled as gifted, and then you flunk a course or two. Mm-hmm. Would that be a non-qualifier?
That's an interesting question. So before I was a researcher, I was actually a gifted specialist in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania, unlike Connecticut, had a mandate for gifted education. And in fact, it was considered part of special education back then. They've kind of changed things a little bit, but very, very sort of strong gifted regulations. So I worked in middle school and high school, and I worked with 7th and 8th and 9th, a lot of 7th and 8th grade, honestly, mostly boys, who had been identified as gifted way back in early elementary school. And because Pennsylvania had such strong sort of regulations, we had to write individual education plans, IEPs, for every gifted student. So I'd sit down with the parents at the beginning of the year, actually the end of the year before, and we'd write out an individual education plan to meet their needs as gifted. And these parents would come in and say, you know, my son was identified as gifted as when he was five, but now, you know, he's in middle school and he's getting C's or D's or F's, and I, you know, I know he's smart, but he's not doing well in school, and so basically I want you to fix him. And that's what they would want me to sort of put in this IEP, is that, you know, I'll work with your child to help them get their grades up, which of course is not exactly what I was supposed to be doing as the gifted specialist. But that's not that uncommon. There are a lot of really bright kids, some identified, some not. A lot of that depends on your state and your district, who don't do well in school, especially when they hit middle school. You know, grades tend to go down in general in middle school. Kids' motivation declines, right? From middle school, there's definitely a decline in adolescence in terms of how school-oriented and how teacher-pleasing kids are. So
we blame it on the opposite sex, then.
They're
getting distracted by girlfriends or boyfriends.
I don't think so.
A little young for that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because if that were the case, then girls' academic motivation should decline faster and first, right? Because I think girls actually get interested in boys way before boys get interested in girls. So I don't know exactly what they're interested in, but it's not school. You know, luckily, lots of kids make a comeback, especially seems like middle school is where the declines in motivation really happen, and they sort of bottom out at the beginning of high school, and they stay unmotivated, but they don't keep getting more and more unmotivated as time goes on. I mean, that again, that's a general trend, but you can be very bright, you can be identified as gifted, and you can have very poor grades. Then the question is, what do you do to turn that all around, right?
Well, can a parent stack the deck, or can parents stack the deck? Let's say their kid is 3, 4, 5 years old, and they would like their child to be in a gifted program. Mm-hmm. Are there things they can do to help the child achieve that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think the more academically enriching things you do with your kids, the more you're helping to stack the deck, right? And that's kind of an interesting thing, too, because kids, the effect of environment on our achievement, our performance, is very strong in early childhood. And it actually wanes throughout our lives. So there have been these studies of, I'm adopted, actually, and there have been these studies of adopted children, and of twins that are separated at birth, but they're a lot harder to find than adopted children. So you can imagine there are more studies on adopted children. And they found, actually, that when they look at the IQs of adopted children and their adopted parents, the IQs are, you know, correlated in early childhood. And that correlation, that relationship between your parents' IQ and your IQ, which is pretty strong when you're a little kid, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And by the time you're an adult, the correlation between an adopted child, an adopted person's IQ and their adopted parents' IQ is near zero, or it is zero. Basically, is no relationship. What that means is you can stack the deck in early childhood by providing lots of enriching activities and opportunities. You talk to your kids, you read to your kids, you teach your kids some math, you take them to museums, right? All of those things will help your kids to be, you know, a little further ahead when they get to school, which is, by the way, one of the reasons that you might see that students of poverty might be less likely to be identified as gifted, right? Because we know that, you know, the more resources you have in the home, the easier it is to do all of those things. If you're working three jobs just to make ends meet, you're not going to be able to take your kids to museums and, you know, do all those, you send your kids to expensive summer camps where they do, you know, computer programming, you know, all those kinds of things. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Professor Ueno has a theory that's very similar to what you said, that if you want to give the kid a head start, start. A, before they can read, you read to them. You read to them a lot. And then once they learn how to read, you encourage that. You inspire that. Because in my opinion, and my mom was an elementary school teacher, in my opinion, everything spins off of reading. If you can't read, or if you're a slow reader or a bad reader, then you don't comprehend the rest of the stuff you're learning in school. So I think if you want to give the kid a head start, you do that with reading. And first you read to them, and after that you go on and let them read, try to inspire that. This study that you've done about students in poverty being less likely to be identified as gifted, now what do you do with it? What is the next step? How do you make this available? How do you take action on what you learned?
Well, that's a really good question, because it's kind of a depressing study, right? I mean, so we found
go home at night, I couldn't sleep, that kind of stuff.
So, okay, so we know that students in poverty are less likely to be identified as gifted. The problem's probably worse than we realized. And then once you control for achievement, right, things look a little better, but not enough, not completely. So, yeah, what do we do with that? Well, I think... So part of our problem is we know that it's a problem, and we have some theories about why it's a problem. But of course, with the data that we have, we can't know for sure exactly why this problem exists. But one of the things that the article that you know that you saw made reference to is we started kind of looking at how does this sort of play out in schools and in districts? And it really looks like, and that varies by state, by the way. So there are three different states. And one of the three states, it's really noticeable that even though the state has a mandate, you must have gifted programs, you know, absolutely must have them, there are a pretty decent number of schools in that state. I mean, it's small, but it's, you know, like 40 or 50, I think it's like about 40 schools that had no gifted students in the school, at least for the, you know, the time period that we were looking at.
Does that mean not identified as gifted? They might have had them, they just weren't identified.
Yeah. When I'm saying gifted, I mean identified as gifted. I have no idea about sort of, you know, people's actual latent giftedness, but no identified gifted students. And those schools were way, way, way more likely to be high, high, high poverty schools. So here's my kind of theory. So you're the principal. You're sitting in a school that's a very high poverty school. You've got all kinds of issues in your school, behavioral issues, academic issues, you know, just all kinds of, you know, sort of a whirlwind of problems in your school. What's going to be kind of low on your priority list? Gifted programs, right? I mean, I can almost hear when I looked at the data, I could hear the principal of this school where, like, they're trying to keep, you know, they're trying to keep the school together because there may be so many problems and so many big issues, like kids coming to school hungry or, you know, kids whose parents don't have a place to live or things like that. And you say to him, but you're not identifying kids as gifted. And I can just hear him saying, like, you know, sue me, right? Like, this is the least of my problems. Let the state come after me because I don't have any gifted kids in my school. I think if the state comes after me, you know, there are going to be other things they're going to be worried about before they're worried about this lack of gifted, you know, the lack of kids identified as gifted. I have no doubt that's true. But what that means is that in the places that have the most, you know, severe poverty, maybe nobody's even looking to identify students as gifted. And if they're sitting in schools that are already kind of having trouble because they have so many other needs, they're probably not getting an education that's really going to be challenging them. And so what happens is there are these really bright kids sitting in these really poor schools who are falling further and further behind their advantaged peers in places, you know, in suburban places or in more affluent areas. And, you know, if you sit in a school system not being challenged, even if you started out as a bright kid, if you sit there for 13 years not being challenged, you are going to fall behind, and it may be impossible to catch up as an adult.
Dr. Betsy McCoach, who is the recipient of the Zirkle Teaching Award from the University. Tell me about that, Betsy.
Okay. Well, there's actually a really funny story. I hope I don't get in trouble for telling it, about the Zirkle Award. So way back when I was an assistant professor, which was a long time ago, it's got to be, okay, it's not that long ago, but pro- probably close to 15 years ago.
Yeah, you're approaching Medicare now, right?
Yeah, well, no, but I mean, this is my 15th year as a faculty member, and it was in my first 5 years somewhere as a faculty member. Actually, I think Zirkel approached UConn about wanting to set up some sort of a teaching award, and the first time around, it didn't actually sort of fell through. You know, he want because the way it works is the person donates money to the foundation, right, and then that money gets allotted for these awards. Anyway, he wanted the award to be given to somebody who was considered a good teacher, but who didn't engage in inflationary grading practices. So he wanted somebody who gave grades on a, you know, I don't know if he said it had to be a normal curve, but he wanted somebody who was a very strict grader. And anyway, the whole thing fell through 10 or 15 years ago. Somehow it didn't happen. And then just a couple of years ago, I guess they got back in talks again and they were able to work it out. But one of the criteria for the award is, I mean, and the whole sort of goal of the award was to give the award to somebody who is a good teacher, who's considered to be a good teacher, but who is hard in their grading. I that's not exactly how they put it in the award. They soften the language, but we have all kinds of jokes that I have all kinds of jokes I tell about the you know, this is the tough teacher award, right? I've gotten this award because I'm like the toughest grader in the School of Ed. And that probably is actually that may or may not be true, but it probably is because I have been known to give some not very good grades to grad students, and so you know, I sometimes wonder, did I get the award because I teach well, or did I get the award because I grade harshly? I like to think that it's both, which is supposed to be the criteria for the award. But I don't know, maybe it was those D's that I gave to those grad students that clinched the award for me.
So, you know, using the parlance from my UConn days, the Betsy McCoach classes are not gut courses.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Everybody knows, you know, I had a student walk into a class this fall and she said, I notice on your syllabus that you don't say that you give A pluses. This is a weird thing about UConn, by the way. In the undergrad programs, you can't get A pluses. The A is the highest grade. But for some reason in graduate school, you can actually get A pluses. And so anyway, she said, I notice you don't have A pluses on your syllabus. You know, does that mean you don't give A pluses? And I said, you know, you'll be lucky to get an A. Don't worry about the A plus.
But by the same token, do you get students who down the road after your classes come back to you and they say, thanks for being tough because it made me a better teacher or whatever they do?
Yeah, they say, I have a lot of people at the end of the class or afterwards say, you know, this was a tough class. I worked really hard. I got an A and I know I really deserved it, or I got a B and I was really like, I can't believe I'm saying I was really thankful to, you know, get a B, but I am, and I learned a lot, and I'm glad I took the class, even though it was a really tough class. So I think people, you know, I don't know. I think people appreciate that they have, you know, that they have to earn their grades. I think if you walk into a class and you know that everybody's going to get an A right off the bat, then it sort of cheapens the whole getting of the A, right? Like, it doesn't mean anything anymore. Grades, an A should mean you know, you really know your stuff, right? And you've excelled in this class. And there's nothing wrong with a B. You know, I joke with, well, this is probably not fair, but I joke sometimes that I feel like, you know, they're tougher graders over at E.O. Smith, than some of the grad programs. Not everybody's going to get an A all the time, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with a B.
Speaking of Zirkel and the Zirkel Award, he is a former head of the education department at Lehigh University, former dean of the College of Education. You have a Lehigh connection as well.
I do. I got my master's degree at Lehigh, and I actually lived right next to the campus for several years when I was teaching in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up. So I have a strong Lehigh connection. And I actually, I've never met Dr. Zirkel, but he was, I've had a lot of emails back and forth with him because I edited a journal and he actually did reviews for our journal. So it was kind of nice to get the award because I knew who he was, and he He's a very respected scholar. He does educational law stuff. So that was kind of a nice connection, too.
This topic that we're discussing this morning, how students in poverty seem less likely to be identified as gifted, does that become a teaching point to your education students at UConn that maybe they can use down the road in their educational career?
Yeah, I mean, so before the break, we were talking about the idea that there probably are some systemic school-based reasons that students in poverty are less likely to be identified. But I think there also are potentially some teacher-related issues too, right? That I believe that, again, this isn't what we did our research on, but I think that teachers are used to sort of thinking of gifted students as looking a certain way or acting a certain way. And so you're more likely to nominate students for identification if they sort of meet what's in your head about, you know, that sort of implicit idea about what a gifted student should look like or should sound like. And so I think that we need to do a better job of training teachers so that they don't have those kinds of biases, so that they really look for talent and look for giftedness in all types of students, no matter where they come from. And I think, you know, I think teachers would say, well, yeah, I know. I know that bright kids could be all colors and, you know, sort of all shapes and sizes. But I think one place where we probably have biases that we don't even realize is actually in terms of the way that students speak. So I believe that in general, people tend to think that people are less intelligent if they use incorrect grammar, if they use slang. And so I actually think that is probably one of the next frontiers where we need to do some research and we need to do better professional development, is to really make sure that teachers aren't judging kids based on how they speak. Because I think they know not to base it on how kids look, but I don't think they really think about speech as much.
I love the name of this study, Disentangling the Roles of Institutional and Individual Poverty in the Identification of Gifted Students. Wow, that'll fit on your business card. Has there been any other studies nationally like this one?
This is the biggest national study of its kind, as far as I know. Well, it is. It is. And there really haven't been, there have been a lot of studies that have used sort of public data to show that under-identification is a problem for, you know, students of different ethnicities or for students of poverty. More of that has revolved around looking at race and ethnicity, because that data is available from the Office of Civil Rights, and I don't think the Office of Civil Rights has any of the – well, I know they don't have any free lunch data. So a lot of people have used public data to show that there are problems in terms of under-identification of certain groups of students. But what makes this study really unique is that we were able to actually control for achievement, which means we said, okay, put these kids on us the same, you know, two kids with the same achievement level. One is rich and one is poor. Not rich. One is not free lunch and one is free lunch. And we were able to show that still they're less likely to be identified, which I think was shocking to us and to a lot of people. So, yeah, this is the biggest study of its kind, really.
You touched on language, and I'm thinking about the effect of the identification of gifted low-income students who might have English as a second language.
Absolutely.
You might have a bright kid, but they struggle a little bit because English is their second language. How do you handle that?
Well, that is very true. And so that's another group that we actually looked at. It's not in this paper, but in the larger study, we looked at English learners who are also so the bad news is, if you're an English learner, you're less likely to be identified as gifted. Well, actually, no, I shouldn't say that. I gotta qualify that. If you're an English learner, you're less likely to be identified as gifted. That's true. But now, once you control for achievement and race and ethnicity and free lunch status, okay, so now holding all of that constant, it turns out that in one of the three states, EL students were less likely to be identified as gifted, in one of the three states, there was no difference, and in one of the three states, they were more likely to be identified as gifted. That was the one variable that turned out to be really kind of strange in our research. But see, English learner status is very, it's very related to race, ethnicity, and to poverty, right? So if you have all three of those strikes, you're definitely going to be less likely to be identified as gifted. So if you're an English learner who is, you know, Black or Hispanic, who is also a free lunch eligible student, then the probability that you're going to be identified as gifted is quite low, even when your scores, I mean, it's quite low. It's better if you have high achievement scores, but it's still not as good as it should be.
Why is it important to identify gifted low-income students?
Why is it important? Well, I think that as a country, we really sort of pride ourselves on the idea that, you know, that we have upward mobility. And upward mobility, I mean, we're sort of a meritocracy in some ways, and that's really predicated on the idea that you could really, you know, if you are bright and you work hard, that you can actually get ahead. But if it turns out that all of the, you know, if it turns out that really bright students who live in poverty don't actually get recognized, they don't get some of the same advantages that more affluent bright students get, then it makes it a lot harder for them to actually make that climb out, you know, not out, but to make that climb in terms of being able to actually, you know, move forward. And so I think it's really, really important to be identifying gifted students of poverty.
So how can we improve that identification?
So I think part of it, you know, revolves around the schools and the districts, thinking about how they make those identification, you know, how they make the decision about identification. Part of it revolves around the teachers. But I think that probably the single easiest thing that schools could do or districts could do right now is to make sure that their identification systems really identify the top students in each school. So often districts make identification decisions district-wide. So they, you know, say you're Hartford or something, and you say, okay, I'm going to identify the gifted students in this district. And you make criteria, and you pick students. But really, in every school, there are going to be students who are struggling and students who could do more, right? So it doesn't really matter how high or low the school is. There are going to be a few kids in that school who are bored by the curriculum, the way it's taught. And so we should, if districts just said, we're going to identify the top, I don't know, X percent in the school, we're going to make sure that we find the kids in each school who need more and we're going to give them more, then I think that would solve a lot of the problem. Because what we see in some of the data is that, again, poor schools have very few or no students identified as gifted, whereas the richer schools in the same district, by the way, so this is like there are some big, big districts. And in that big district, the more affluent schools have a large percentage of gifted students, and the less affluent schools have very, very low percentages of gifted students. And if you think about that, if you're sort of giving, right, you're sort of giving the goodies to the schools that are already more affluent in terms of if you consider the gifted program a goodie, then you're just exacerbating those gaps that already exist, which I think is a big problem.
So, Betsy, what's your next research project, or what are you working on now?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so, well, we're still working on this one. That's a lot of data. So we're continuing to work on the identification stuff, but we're also working on a big Phase 2 project for the grant right now, where we have one which very large district, which shall remain nameless, and they actually have – it's not in the state. They actually have over 200 elementary schools in the district. So you know it's not in the state because we don't have any districts that big. And they have three different types, actually four different types of gifted programming in that district because it's so big. So some of the schools have part-time reading classes for gifted students. Some of the schools have part-time, like, so all the gifted kids are in a reading class together, but then they're mixed for their other classes. Some of the schools have part-time math, so they're all the gifted kids are together for math, but then they're mixed for everything else. Some of the schools have full-time, so the kids are gifted kids are in a homeroom together. They travel together all throughout the day. And some of the schools have just itinerant gifted services, which I'm not exactly sure what they do there, but they've got one teacher floating around between several schools in a week. So they just, it's more of a pull-out program. And we've got all of the data from that district, and we're going to look to see if we can see, does gifted programming make a difference, which is what I said our second research, big research goal is. So I don't know yet, but in a couple of years, I can come back and tell you.
All right, you're invited back because it was a fun discussion this morning. Students in poverty, less likely to be identified as gifted. The big survey, the big study done by Dr. Betsy McCoach and other people as well. Betsy's a professor in the Research Methods Measurement Evaluation Program in the Educational Psychology Department of the University of Connecticut. Betsy, good to see you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.